He was Speaker of the House.
He was Speaker of the House, yes. And matter of fact, the youngest Speaker of the House, I guess it was ever in all the legislature. And up until that time, at least, I was the youngest senator that was ever elected in Alaska. And then...
How old were both of you?
Well, let's see, I was about 46, maybe 35. Mm-hmm. And Stan was 7 years younger than I was.
You're 28.
Yeah. So then, the next, let's see, 46... I served the special session of 46 and the regular session of 46, and then I think my term was up, and Stanley and I switched because he had seniority over me, and I said, well, okay, you want to run for the Senate, go ahead. Well, he had unfortunately subscribed to Bess Cross's theory of putting Alaska back into prohibition, and of course that had ired the liquor industry very severely, and they spent a considerable amount of money, and Stanley got beaten, but I got through. Mm-hmm. So I was the minority leader in the House in 1947, and Bill Egan was in the House at that time, then former Governor Egan was in the House, so I was minority leader there. And then the next time around, the House being 2 years, 49, I ran for the Senate again, and I was elected for a couple of more sessions there.
Who were the lawyers in the legislature while you were there?
Well,
Warren Taylor, I know, must have been.
Yes, Warren Taylor was in. Morris Anderson from Morris Johnson from Fairbanks. Doc Walker was in the. No, Doc Walker wasn't an attorney. He was a pharmacist.
Was McNeely in?
McNeely was in the House, I think, yeah. See, with the Shattucks. Either with the Shattucks were attorneys. Ralph Rivers was Attorney General. Well, Skivinius was in for one session that I remember. I don't know whether it was precisely when I was there or whether it wasn't later on.
Could you tell me a little bit about Warren Taylor?
Well, Warren Taylor was kind of an old-timer in the country. I didn't know what he did before he adopted the stance as an attorney. But he was... The first time I really got well acquainted with Warren Taylor, he was the district attorney for the 3rd Division. And then, I think after Warren Taylor was Judge Kehoe. Did you see Kehoe's name on here? Okay, Kehoe. No, Kehoe, Joe Kehoe, yeah. And Warren practiced law here in Anchorage for a while. I'm not precisely sure what years it was. He practiced law in Cordova. And then after that, and he'd been in the legislature off and on for a good number of years, principally out of Cordova. Then he moved up to Fairbanks about the end of World War II and was in Fairbanks henceforth from then on. And then I think his son went out and studied law and was a partner with him for a bit and then went down to Kodiak and was down there, and I don't know where he is now.
Is it a judge up in Fairbanks?
Oh, he is?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Everett Hepp, who was a judge up there, came to Alaska as a Well, he worked with me in the OPA first time I ever saw him, he came to work in my office in Fairbanks in the OPA and was an investigator. But he was already an attorney. He passed his bar in California. I think Wendell Kay came up here as an attorney for the FHA. Mm-hmm. And that must have been in the very early 40s. And then whenever that, I think it was FHA, one of those government units that, belonged to the housing situation. Right. Yeah. And once that job was through, they made another appointment with any practice law in Anchorage or all those times since then. And he was in the legislature when I was in the legislature.
Uh-huh. Why do you smile?
Oh, we had some great times together.
What happened in the legislature?
Well, Wendell was always quite a, not only a whip, but a pretty sly about getting things around to his thinking. Matter of fact, Wendell was the father, I think, of the Constitutional Convention Act, and managed to get that through. In the legislature, I didn't ever get a chance to get many bills passed. I introduced the first bill that would prohibit signboards along the highways, mm-hmm. and it didn't pass that time. And then Warren Taylor put it through the House the next time, and it did pass the legislature, so that's why there are no billboards along the highways. Another thing that I introduced was the taxes on tobacco of all natures. And Barney Gottstein's father had called me in one day to his place and said, "You realize how much tobacco is used in this state or in this territory?" And I said, "I'm the slightest idea," and he showed me a couple of invoices, and I was absolutely flabbergasted. And he says, if you'd put a tax on cigarettes and cigars, he said, you'd be surprised how much money it'd bring in. So I developed a tax program for cigarettes and all sorts of tobacco. And it didn't pass the first time. And I forgot who brought it up the next time. And it did. But I had put a rider on that particular thing, and we could do it in those days, put a rider on it, that it would be the tax money would be dispensed to the schools, the school districts of the state. On a pro rata, per capita basis, I should say, and that bill did pass, and that's about the only thing I guess I could ever take any credit for. But
in the 1950s, Stanley was working with Buell Mesa. Do you know how that partnership came about?
Well, I believe that Stanley was practicing law alone at that particular time, and Nesbitt had just recently come from the military. I think he'd just gotten out of service, and he was an attorney. Whether he had been an attorney in the service or not, I'm not sure. But anyhow, he was an attorney, and things were beginning to kind of burgeon in the area of law and law requirements, and Stanley was more involved in criminal practice than he was in civil practice, mm-hmm. and I think the thought of the partnership there was that Nesbitt would handle the civil practices and Stanley would continue with the criminal practices, mm-hmm. and I think that's how that partnership evolved, and they were partners for quite a good number of years.
Do you know how Stanley got involved with the Tyonics?
Well, both Stanley and I knew a lot of the Tyonic young people because we'd worked on the railroad with a good many of them. And the community was a kind of an up-and-down sort of arrangement. If there wasn't much fish with the natives over there, Dan would starve to death. And Stanley had an airplane, and a little later on I had an airplane, and so We'd be flying over there from time to time and seeing what was going on. They didn't have any food or anything. We'd haul over a bunch of grub for them, and oftentimes Stanley would buy it himself, or I'd pick up whatever I had available and take it over there. And sometimes I'd have extra meat that I had wouldn't need because I'd been out hunting, got moose and caribou and so forth, so I'd take over an airplane load of meat to those people. And consequently, when they needed any kind of help in the legal field, who are they going to turn to? They're going to turn to Stanley because they know him. And Stanley was always quite honorable with them. And consequently, when they got into the situation of getting money for their oil, one of the things I think it was one of the smart things that Stanley ever did for the Taonics was to beat the government out of the $12 million and give the Taonics an opportunity to run it instead of running it through the Department of Interior, Bureau of Indian Affairs, and letting them invest it and do whatever is necessary. And so with Stanley's aid and advice, and I think the aid and advice of several other people, they embarked on a program of updating the village and making proper investments with their money, and I think it's proved to be a good thing. And as a matter of fact, the Taonics supplied a hell of a lot of money for the rest of the savages in Alaska to lobby Congress for the act.
How did Stanley feel about Native work?
How
did he get involved in all the...
Most of it he did for nothing. Mm-hmm. That was one aspect of his liberalism. He wanted to see them get their just desserts, and I suppose he got some fees out of it, but not in the sense that some other people who later on represented them attempted to get.
Mm-hmm. Why did he do it?
Well, I think that was one of his philanthropic motivation, probably. That's one place. He knew that his expertise, he was an Alaskan born, he knew the situation, and he could speak forcefully for them as well as with them. Mm-hmm. And I think that was just where he put his charity money.
Uh-huh. Were there other philanthropic things he did? Or were there other things that were evident?
There were a number of them, but he never talked about them.
Can you tell me about them?
I don't know about them. Mm-hmm. I know that a lot of things that he helped a lot of... for instance, he helped a lot of the old foreigners get their citizenships. Mm-hmm. And I doubt if he ever charged them. And a lot of people he kept out of jail that he never charged. I can't think of specifically some rather notable charity that he was accomplished, but I knew, and I have known since that time, because I've heard from a lot of people who I didn't know that he even knew, and said that, well, if it wasn't for Stanley, I'd have lost my home, or I'd have lost my place, or I'd have lost my... And I said, didn't he take a half interest in it? He said, no, he never took a dime, outside of the filing fees and whatnot. So I know that, and there was a lot of people who thought very highly of him, and especially Joe Blow citizens. There's some politicians who didn't think so highly of him, or me either. That's neither here nor there.
Bill Arnold, can you tell me a little bit about W.C. Arnold?
W.C. Arnold is an intelligent attorney. He is probably one of the smartest attorneys in coastal area problems that there is in the United States, or at least he has been at a certain stage of the game. There may be others now, but I know that in water rights and ocean problem, I've forgotten what kind of marine law, and a pretty damned astute attorney in any other areas. He was the most formidable opponent to statehood in the legislature. And while he didn't ever run for the legislature, he was always there at the beck and call of the canned salmon industry, and he was a formidable lobbyist. And if the territory of Alaska had followed a suggestion I once made to our group in caucus. I said, look, I don't know how much the canned salmon industry pays Bill Arnold, but let's us pay him twice as much as the canned salmon industry does. And I says, we'll have statehood in a couple of years. There won't be any problem about it. And we would have. There isn't any equivocation. And I have talked to Bill Arnold a number of times since. I said, for God's sake, Bill, before the old man rings the bell upstairs, I said, put down the other side of the statehood story before it's too late. Oh, he said, well, he says, I couldn't do that. It embarrassed too many people. And I said, put it in limbo. I said, put it 50 years on it if you want to, or 25 years on it, that it never can be opened or published until this time has passed. But I said, put it down, because you're the only one who has all of that inside material on the anti-statehood business. And I said, you certainly commanded respect with many, many congressmen, and I said, you knew who was doing what to whom and why. And I said, that should be part of our history. I don't think he's ever going to do it, but anyhow, Bill was, as I say, was a formidable opponent in statehood, but...
Who were his allies?
Well, some of the legislators, for instance, Doc Walker from Ketchikan, the Shattucks from Nome were in his camp. The mining industry and the canned salmon industry were pretty close together, and Morris Johnson represented the mining industry a great deal. And then there was another guy, what the hell was his name?
Odie Cochran?
Yes, Odie Cochran is right, I should say. And there was another chap from Nome.
Ira Orton?
No, No, I guess this was a mining man. He wasn't an attorney. But then the Ziegler's were pretty much with him, because Ketchikan, of course, was a fishing town. There's no question about it. And I just can't remember the others. But those were some of the people with whom he worked in the legislature. Then, of course, there was a number of very small people in the legislature who were not attorneys and were practically nothing else. And there was a key vote in the Senate one time, and one of the chaps from a place in southeastern Alaska, not too far away from Ketchikan, was the swing vote on whether this particular thing was going to transpire. And I think it was on taxes, a tax on canned salmon. And he sold his vote for a case of whiskey, an overcoat, a suit of clothes, and a trip to Seattle.
All paid for by who?
By you know who.
Oh. I suppose crude in a sense. Was it that easy to buy votes at that time?
Yes, with some people it was. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Did some of the lawyers in the legislature do things for their clients? Was it a very free and easy kind of way of pushing through bills that were going to help clients?
I can't say that any of the attorneys, to my knowledge, over the years that I was connected with the legislature and to my political knowledge, that there was an attorney ever pushed a special bill to benefit a client. There were a number of attorneys who pushed special bills to aid an industry, but not, and I suppose you could call a whole industry a client. Yes, there were a number of those occasions, but to push a special bill which would benefit them personally or any special person, I would say no. We had a couple of attorneys who shot some pretty close corners. One of them got disbarred in southeastern Alaska for doing some such thing as that. But, But by and large, where the the attorneys, you might say, stooped to any method to get a bill passed. I don't think there was ever any chicanery in the sense that it was an outright breach of ethics, mm-hmm. not an outright breach of ethics. Some of it might be a little shadowy, but I couldn't say that the attorneys had a bad name in the sense that they were in there and smarter than other people in methods of law and were using that to benefit themselves or some particular group other than a whole industry. Well, a whole industry, of course, benefits a whole aspect of the society, so therefore you can't say that that's bad.
Was O.D. Cochran, can you tell me a little bit about O.D. Cochran?
Well, he was a kind of crusty old guy. Must have been 100 years old. I guess he was 80-something. And he was pretty narrow-sighted. All he was concerned with primarily is keeping any kind of bills or taxes off the mining industry. And he was a mining attorney. There's no question about it. And in being sure that he had the horsepower to do that, why, he sided with the canned salmon industry. And whatever Bill Arnold would want, why, O.D. Cochran would okay, as far as he was concerned. But outside of that, why, I don't think he was particularly brilliant or particularly stupid. He went down there to spend his time to see that nothing happened to the mining industry, and that was it. And he was not the only person that was down there for that kind of a reason.
Who else was down there for that kind of reason?
Well, he was not an attorney. He was a man from Nome, and his name wouldn't be on this list. I can't think of it. I know where he sat in the house. Oh, yeah, you asked me earlier about how did I get into politics. Well, after I had been involved in helping my dad in these several campaigns, in 1933, I went down to Juneau and was one of the employees in the House offices. Uh-huh. And then in 1935, I went back again. Always the idea that I was going to sometime run for the legislature, and I wanted to know the workings on both ends of the banana.
Yeah.
So I worked in 1935 and 1933. I worked in the House offices.
Did you know Henry Roden?
Yes, quite well. Matter of fact, Henry Roden led the troops in trying to throw me out of the Senate when I was elected in 1946.
Why?
Well, because the law read that you must be a resident of the area from which you run. Well, I ran under the premise that I was a resident of Alaska because of the 3rd District. And I had been living in Fairbanks. And they maintained that because of my residence in Fairbanks that I hadn't resided long enough in the 3rd District to reestablish my voting rights. So anyhow, there was quite a hullabaloo about it, and they had a sort of a after-hours caucus or a trial or something like that. And Henry Roden was the one that was leading the pack to get me ejected because he felt that I was a henchman of Greening's. And Greening was very unpopular with the group of those people, particularly the canned salmon industry. And Henry Roden was a mining and canned salmon industry attorney, and who had been also district attorney, attorney general for the territory. So in any event, why, he didn't have quite the votes to throw me out, and I wouldn't leave or resign, and John Butrovich, a Republican from Fairbanks, was the one that carried the ball on my behalf. He says, regardless of where you're from, he says, you're born in Alaska, he is an Alaskan, and there isn't any other way about it. And he says, as far as I'm concerned, he's representing his people and my people too. Yes! You know, and I served the special session and several more sessions after that.
Well, that's good. What about the Juneau lawyers like the Faulkner and Robertson?
Faulkner and Robertson were all industry canned salmon people, all absolutely out of statehood. Matter of fact, I don't recall that there was any attorney in Juneau who was pro-statehood.
Mildred Herman?
Mildred Herman was, yes. Yes, no question about that. She was. But I don't recall, of course, if I had the list of all the attorneys there, I could tell immediately, but your paper is the way it's arranged here.
It doesn't say where
no.
they are, yeah.
If you had them arranged by communities, I think you'd find it easier for people to make references to it.
To which ones?
Yeah. See, E.P. McCarron down there was, he was the OPA attorney.
Uh-huh.
I don't know whether he practiced law after he got out of the OPA or not. I don't know.
E.P. McCarron also was up in Fairbanks, wasn't he?
Yeah, he might have been.
Yeah, they remember him up there.
Oh, do they?
Yeah.
Oh, maybe after OPA days, he moved to Fairbanks and practiced law.
That's what he did, yeah. In the 1950s in Anchorage, what was it like?
Well, the community, of course, was a great deal smaller than it is now, and there weren't nearly as many people, obviously. And otherwise, well, there wasn't the big money floating around like there is now. But otherwise, I suppose that there were less social activities because there weren't as many people. There were less things to be interested in because there weren't enough people to support interests in a variety of things like there is at this particular time. But outside of that, why I can't see any great differences, except there's four times as much traffic now as there used to be.
In the 1950s, Stanley had a bank with Beal Nesbitt, the Union Bank. What happened with the bank and the surrounding circumstances? Can you tell me a little bit?
Yeah, I can tell you, but you'll have to shut that off. Stanley was the person who carried all the legislative programs of Governor Greening's. And he was, in essence, like to Governor Greening, like a son, really. And he did all of the things that Greening couldn't do for himself because he was governor. And he carried the legislative program on all the rest of these things, and consequently was quite a potent force in the fight for statehood and opposition to the Can-Am industry. And consequently, there was a very serious effort to try to down him in some fashion or another. And consequently, out of that spun these investigations by the government and the investigation of the bank and all the trouble that accrued.
Was it an organized effort, or was it?
Well, I don't know whether it was or not, but it sure looked very suspiciously like an organized effort because the things seemed to come one after the other, and there was hardly any let-up in it for several years. And I always felt that there was an organized effort. It didn't splash off onto me particularly because outside of auditing that account that I just spoke of, it didn't splash off onto me because there was no place they could get at me. So I didn't feel all the heat of it.
Who would you have said organized it?
Well, there was a chap by the name of Jensen who was in the legislature and who was a very rabid opponent of statehood and who did what I prefer to call a lot of the dirty work for Bill Arnold and some of his people. And Jensen was the one that oftentimes carried the word back to somebody in Washington, whoever the hell it was, that was trying to get at him, and I think he's the one that inferred to the McCarthy group, this is just my own opinion, inferred to the McCarthy group that Stanley was a subversive, because he was such a close friend of Greening's, and Jensen hated Greening like he hated poison. And consequently, why, I think that was part of the, where the orchestration for all of the harassment came from.
Did the Red Hunters or whatever, the McCarthy people, how did they harass Stanley? What did they?
Well, I don't know all of the circumstances, but I know that they sent up a prominent attorney here. I've forgotten what the hell his name was, but he's a prominent attorney, and they went through him for, I don't know, days on end. What the testimony was what they were aiming at, I can't tell you. I don't know. Because Stanley didn't ever tell me. But I know he used to be kind of looking a little pensive once in a while when he'd come from one of these sessions.
Mm-hmm. Who were Stanley's allies?
Well, we had a few people who worked with us. Warren Taylor was a very good friend of his, and I don't know whether he was directly involved in any of this in helping to defeat any of these aggressive tendencies that were being practiced. Well, Wendell Kay was always quite a good friend. Roger Cremo was a good friend of Stanley's. And there were several other attorneys that he'd done some favors for who were very friendly toward him. Now, whether they actually were allies in the sense that you use the word, well, I couldn't say. I don't know about that.
Yeah.
But in the legislative field, why? Warren Taylor was probably the most aggressive in helping Stanley
get
the legislation through. Yeah, he and Stanley were very close in that respect.
Why didn't Greening come to his defense?
Well, I can't be sure, except that Greening was very friendly with Elmer Rasmussen. Greening always held himself aside from politics. He purported to be a Democrat and purported not to be a Republican, but if anything, he was an independent. He was Governor Greening, period. And he was above the machinations of political situations if he could avoid them. Whether that was a characteristic of Jewish people, I don't know. Whether it's characteristic of a very, very intelligent man, that I couldn't tell you. But I know that it was his character that he seldom ever put much on the line on behalf of anybody in the party who had ever been supportive of him. The bulk of his appointments were not made with regard to our political group. I don't think he ever took the word of the district chairman of the committee, and I was for a good number of years. Of course, I could understand that because Greening didn't particularly care for me. I was too outspoken in the confines of our caucuses and our meetings and so forth. I was the one who always told him when I thought he was wrong, and the governor didn't prefer that kind of talk from anybody, in particular somebody who felt that it was his inferior intelligence, had an inferior intelligence to his. And of course, I always spoke up from the standpoint of the party and from what I thought was going to benefit the party organization. And he wasn't certainly the deity, and he wasn't always right, but he was generally always right. But anyhow, I was the one who castigated him in the privacy of our meetings, and he just couldn't find himself friendly in that kind of a situation. He didn't like anybody who opposed him, period.
Where does J. Gerald Williams fit in?
Well, he really doesn't fit in.
He was Attorney General?
Yes.
Who was prosecuting? Who was...
The fish traps is a very important thing in the sense of our society in this respect. Fish traps were controlled by the federal government through the federal fish, commercial fisheries. The fish traps were assigned to various persons, oftentimes from Washington's orders, because Mr. Fish could talk to somebody back there. So that the bulk of the majority of the successful fish traps were owned by corporations or private people, all canned salmon types of people. There were very, very few fish traps that were held by anybody else. Well, a fish trap is the most efficient way and the best way of catching salmon. But unless it is run intelligently and properly controlled, it can decimate the salmon runs, principally because salmon runs to a certain creek run in schools. If fish trap is fishing, it'll catch the whole bloody school. There won't be enough escapement to propagate a creek, so the creek is dead for many, many years. And consequently, because of this, the bulk of the fish that were being taken for the canned salmon industry were coming out of fish traps. And they were also reducing the fish runs in areas where the gill netters and the seiners could fish. So there was quite a reason to want to dispose of that so they could distribute more widely the fishing ability. And this was one of the things that was one thing that helped statehood in Alaska considerably was the fact that the fishermen wanted to see us get control of it so our own fisheries department could allocate the fish based on biological reasons rather than private necessity. Or not necessity, but patronage, private patronage. And the canned salmon industry, I'm sure, knew that what would happen if we ever got statehood, and that's why they're so adamant about Greening or anybody connected with the statehood movement. So when our Constitution was presented to the public, one of the things that went with it was abolition of fish traps. And that was what I think probably one of the major things that put the acceptance of the Constitution clear over the top, you know, beyond any question of a doubt what the people wanted. In the Constitutional Convention, I was the chairman of the Legislative Branch Committee. And we had quite a number of attorneys in there. I think I marked them all out the other day, and out of the group there were 27 attorneys and ex-legislators that were in the Constitutional Convention. But we didn't find any real obstruction from attorneys in the Constitutional Convention. That is any what you might call dirty politics. Even though what's that old timer from
E.B. Collins
from Fairbanks and the other one from Juneau.
Bob Robertson,
yeah. And then there was Morris Johnson, the three real anti-statehood people that were in there. Some others weren't so, were kind of lukewarm, but they were the three that were absolutely anti. And they, outside of a few little practices on the floor, trying to delay or something, you know, little parliamentary procedures, and none of them were a match for me in parliamentary procedures, so that really didn't bother us too much. And sometimes it was kind of amusing. And after the first few go-rounds, they just gave up and went along, and they just vote no, and that was the end of that. And poor old Robertson, he was so mad when it passed and we got all done with it that he wouldn't sign it, but they somebody finally did get him to sign it before he died. So all the signatures are on the Constitution now.
In the 1950s, there were a number of... Harold Stringer. Do you remember Harold Stringer?
Yes. He was in the service when I was in the service.
Can you tell me a little bit about Harold?
Well, I don't know what I could tell you about him particularly. After Harold got out of the service, and I've forgotten what organization he was in, but we used to ride the bus oftentimes together out to the base. He opened a law practice in Anchorage and became involved in, seems to me, Republican politics, and practiced law for quite a while. I don't think he wasn't any great brilliant attorney, but he was certainly a moderately good attorney. And then there was, he got crosswise to some kind of a situation. I guess it hinged on an ethical matter as far as an attorney was concerned. And my brother represented him, if I recall correctly, and saved his bacon on that one. And it wasn't too long after that Harold moved to Washington, D.C., and I guess that's where he is now. Mm-hmm. Whether he's still practicing law there or not, I don't know. I haven't any idea. But he was not... In the politics, he was opposed to us, but he wasn't a particularly vicious person like Noel Winblom, who was a...
Oh, you remember Noel Winblom?
Oh, God almighty, he tried to do everything to us when he was a district attorney. And he was a particularly bad one. Another one was
Noel Winblom a Republican? Is that what you're
saying? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Was he a national committee man, or...
No, I don't recall what he was. Yeah, Robinson.
Paul
Robinson was the other one who was the... He was the worst one. He was. He was a Republican Party hatchet man, is what he was, and he was the one that led the fight on the Palmer Airport scandal and everything else, and which has proven to have been no scandal at all. It benefited the people up there, but anyhow, he tried to... And matter of fact, he did. He was very effective in his radio addresses against Louis McCutcheon's. I can remember that it was... I attribute my loss of my last session to Paul and his diatribes on the radio, always hinting at scandal in the background, you know, and because that primary, I think I got more votes in the primary than any other three senators in the whole territory of Alaska. Mm-hmm. And when it came to the fall election, it was quite a turnaround. I didn't get enough votes to put in one a hat. And I think it was due to Paul's particularly vicious attacks about the Palmer Airport and hinting at other things and so forth.
What about the Palmer Airport?
Well, the opposition maintained that Tony Schwamm, who was then the airport, the chief of the Air National Division...
How do you spell his last name?
S-C-H-W-A-M-M. That they had had some sort of a kickback arrangement on purchasing land for the new airport up there. They didn't have an airport before, and this is their building one. And it was one of the things that Stanley tried to get going in the legislature. And, of course, Tony Schwamm was a good friend of ours and a good Democrat, and so we were working with some of the people up there in Palmer. Well, anyhow, there was the allegation that there was kickback money involved in the purchase of the land. And I think it was taken before the grand jury on at least two occasions, if not more, trying to fix the accusation into concrete. Well, it never developed, and it ultimately was shown that there wasn't any kickback operation, and that the airport properties, whatever the machinations were that were involved in acquiring the airport properties, were all involved among people in Palmer and not among any of the politicians or any of the territorial groups. It was things that they were doing in order to acquire land. So ultimately, our party was absolved from any wrongdoing. But nonetheless, by during that period of time, it gave them a lot of fire to shoot at us. And it was effective. Besides, I think it was time, it was a case when everybody was changing, you know, and it was to throw the rascals out. So they threw out one bunch of rascals and put in another bunch, including Paul Robeson, if I remember correctly.
Was this 1953?
Yeah.
It was a Republican landslide,
yeah,
or whatever.
That's right. Yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah.
In the 1950s, did you see a change maybe between the 1950s and the 1960s after statehood, did you see a change in the communities or a change in the way people were doing things? Was there an effort to modernize? Was there an effort to become a state?
Well, I can't think that there was any real demarcation in the thing. It took several years. I would say it took several years after statehood before people began to realize that things could be run a little differently. Mm-hmm. Had it not been for statehood, I don't think that we would have ever had the gas fields and oil fields down here in Cook's Inlet. It came practically with statehood, so to speak. Because under territorial status, all of our natural resources had been pretty well locked up by the Department of Interior. And until we could get control of those things, like coal leasing and timber sales and mineral oil and gas leasing, we were never going to be able to proceed. Well, even after statehood, it took a little while for the wheel to start rotating. And then people began finally to feel that there was an opportunity to do things under our new state constitution, that the legislature was endeavoring to